We had 17 grand left in the account at one point. I remember this really clearly. And the UFC, believe it or not, was suing us because we had, our brand was called Ultimate Boxer at the time. And they had an issue with us using the word ultimate, which seemed ridiculous, but we had no money at the time to fight a huge organization at this, and it got quite heavy. You know, if you see people saying things that aren't true about you or lying about you or making up things, then it's hard not to respond. But I think I would just, you know, it is pantomime, and trying to stay out of it is better for the sport. And I think that's what I would say to myself, to sort of stay true to why, remember why you started. It doesn't matter how respectful I am in an interview. You can find from this interview, I'm sure, three words that can set, you know, set something on fire. Like, it is, that is what this is about. And at the time, it was very innocent.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Holyfield was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week's podcast is with boxer promoter Ben Shalom, who has, with Sky Sports, been building quite a stable with Joshua Boazzi, Chris Billum-Smith, Lawrence Okolie, Ben Whitaker, Natasha Jonas, Fraser Clark, Adam Azim, Caroline Dubois, and many more. We actually recorded this podcast in a private box stroke suite in the Vitality Stadium a few hours before Billum-Smith dethroned Lawrence Okolie. And it was great to interview Ben about his background. He's often on the treadmill of interviews, talking about what's happened last week and what's coming up next week. So it was great to discuss his background, his start, and his rise. I hadn't actually met Ben properly before a couple of weeks ago, but I had a good feeling after speaking to him several times over the last couple of weeks. And I was really appreciative that he made the time to talk on one of the biggest days of his boxing calendar, which was really good. I really appreciated it. And I found him interesting. Like, you know, you get a vibe for people, and I understand Ben is a quiet guy. He's not your extrovert in the Eddie Hearn sense or in the bombastic Bob Arum or Don King sense, but he is quiet, he's confident, he's going about his business, he's running his own race, trying his hardest to stay in his own lane, which is tough given the landscape of the boxing media in this day and age. But I thought Ben was great. Great company, and I really enjoyed getting to know him over the last few weeks. There are podcasts also up early on my Patreon with Johnny Nelson and with new Hall of Famer Timothy Bradley. Huge thanks to those who support Boxing Life Stories over there at patreon.com/Tristix. And a huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert, impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health, and safety compliance. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's Ben Shalom. Ben, thanks for doing this. I was going to say on fight week, but it's actually fight day.
Yeah.
So you are the guy that came from nowhere,
yeah.
Apparently. Did it feel like that, or did it feel like, you know, it was that, you know, you sort of paid your dues and then arrived?
No, it certainly didn't feel like it, nowhere to us and to myself. Obviously, I think my age, you know, people think it must have happened overnight, but I got my promoter's license when I was 23 years old. I was putting on shows with Carl Greaves' license actually when I first started because I couldn't get my own. And it was a hard journey. It was a long journey. It was probably one I could have only taken being that young, being that, you know, no responsibilities, no family, no one to take care of. I just was able to follow my dream and work for a long time without needing to worry about what money came in or what this. I was just building a team, taking things day by day and step by step, learning about the business, working in all sorts of different capacities on different shows. And it was an unbelievable experience, to be honest. And I think without it, I'd be a very, very different promoter now. And yeah, so overnight, definitely not. But of course, you know, to be doing this in my 20s is pretty special.
It is one of those things where when you've sort of paid your dues at that small hall level, you do feel like you've earned the right to be involved in bigger promotions. You know, like you've served your apprenticeship, right?
Yeah, I think so. Look, don't get me wrong. There's guys still in the small hall circuit that have been doing it 10, 20, 30 years, and I'm full of admiration for them. And they look after their fighters, and they don't make much money, and they do it, and the small hall boxing needs small hall boxing. And so, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of promoters that don't get to this place, and I understand why people might think, why him or why has that happened? But I do feel that we, and when I say we, I've got the same three or four guys closest to me as I had when I first started, and so there's been a long journey together, and we've done everything. We've had to, you know, fund shows just off ticket sales. We've had to bring in sponsors to cover shows because we couldn't get TV dates. We've had to pay for our own production and find presenters from here, there and everywhere, and so many stories of trying to pretend that we had our shit together, really, and we're able to put on shows. I remember the early days with Five Spike, and that was our first TV show, a tournament, and just
did you think you've made it then?
Even now it feels like it's a tough sport. Boxing is a tough sport, and we've always had to take it step by step. But did I feel I made it? No, but it felt exciting. It was my dream. I was working in a sport that I loved. I was working in a sport that I had. I was around fighters, and that's where I you're probably the same. That's where I get my biggest buzz, because the things that they have to go through and the work they have to put in without necessarily a goal in sight. You know, obviously now I work with Olympians and fighters that know they've got a certain trajectory and they're going to make a certain amount of money. But back then, you know, working with local guys and especially where I grew up in Manchester, and who didn't really know where their opportunity was going to come from, who didn't really know if they were ever going to make great money out of the sport, but they did it because they loved it. And the energy you get from that was unbelievable. And as a young guy, that was what kept me going and why I enjoyed it so much.
Did you want to take on the establishment? Did the 23-year-old Ben think there was a gap in the market and think, you know, I can grab this by the bull by the horns?
Yeah, I think, look, I finished studying and I went straight into boxing. I never had a real job, and I'd do matchmaking. I would help out setting up press conferences. I would bring in foreign opponents. I would find ways to get them from the airport to the venue. I worked with a guy in Manchester called James Lindemann, who was a promoter from Manchester, who was just starting out himself. And so I was able to support him, and I was involved in certain Steve Wood shows. Pat Barrett was someone that I knew well when I was starting out in Manchester. So I was able to do loads of different bits and bobs, and I think I always saw boxing as letting itself down. I always felt like there was it was such an amazing sport. When you look at the fighters, you look at the integrity, you look at the potential for entertainment, you look at the honesty that exists within the athletes. I always felt that the sport didn't do enough, and those small hall shows that I used to go to, it felt underdeveloped. It felt like this was a sport that had no language barrier, could be globally huge, and we know it is globally huge on those big events, but had very little infrastructure. And for me, it was, can we create a brand in boxing that changes the perception of it? I didn't like the fact that when I took my mum or my girlfriend to my early events that they felt it was intimidating. I didn't like that. And people might say, well, that's boxing, or that's how it is. And I was always told that, and spit and sawdust, and I respect all that. But when you go to an event, the only way the sport grows is if it's for everyone, and seeing what was going on behind the scenes. And we all know about the problems that exist within the sport. And it just felt like this was for me. I always felt like I was a resourceful, entrepreneurial kid, and always went against the grain. And I felt like this was a sport full of issues, full of problems. And don't get me wrong, nothing can be solved overnight. But that was something that inspired me, and I felt this is what I want to do.
Was it hard to persuade the board in the end to get a promoter's license?
Yeah, I remember going for my interview, and Les Potts, who was a guy in the central area. I used to drive over to see him, and I went to his house a few times, and he'd help me, and we'd go through the rules together. And as I say, at this time I'm 22, 23 years old. Everyone's thinking, how could we trust this kid to put on any sort of show? And it was tough. And so I met Les Potts, I met Carl Greaves, and Carl Greaves was offered me his promoter's license. So he used to put on the show, and it would look like Carl Greaves' show, and I'd be promoting it from behind the scenes. And eventually I got my license, and I actually remember Les helping me with my answers, and I left my notes. I remember going for the board meeting, and I sat down, and it was Robert Smith and Mickey Collier, I think. It was about 8 or 10 of them, and I was thinking, Jesus, this is a... And I could see they were looking at me like, is this guy serious? And I left my... I did the interview. I think I left my notes on my chair, and I think it was quite clear that Les had been helping me, which wasn't too good. But yeah, those early days was difficult, and yeah, since then the board have been very, very good to me.
Did you anticipate getting to this level of being an independent guy on Sky and putting on stadium fights?
Yeah, 100%. And that was the dream. I did things that were always thinking about the long term. We used to do shows where we didn't have enough money in the account to pay the production, and so we'd be waiting on tickets. I remember Florian Mark, who was one of our early boxers, and he'd sell a lot of tickets, so we'd have the money would come in from the cash, and the production company would be going, we're not putting on the event until the money's in our account. But it would seem seamless from behind the scenes, but I'm running with my rucksack to the bank with the cash, depositing it, making the payments, and that was what it was like for a few years. But it was always, we felt like, can we create a brand within the sport? Yes, we have to respect the traditions of the sport, and still do have to today, but longer term, it was all, we've always... We had 17 grand left in the account at one point. I remember this really clearly. And the UFC, believe it or not, was suing us because our brand was called Ultimate Boxer at the time. And they had an issue with us using the word Ultimate, which seemed ridiculous, but we had no money at the time to fight a huge organisation at this. And it got quite heavy. And I had 17 grand left in the account, and I always wanted to change to Boxer, and that was always going to be the brand when we broke into the traditional sort of sport and the big events and the big fights. I felt like that was a brand that could represent where we wanted to go. And boxer.com was the website, and someone else had it, and we ended up having to spend 13 grand of our 17 to get the website. And that's why, you know, it was because we have visions of this, and we still have much bigger visions than this, and that's how we run our business. We invest every penny we have. We've always done it. We always are thinking long term, and yeah, from the very start, from the very, very start, we believed that we'd be in this position.
So I was going to say, where did the love come from? But I understand you were a big fan of Amir Khan, and then Ricky Hatton and David Haye. You kind of went through those years of Khan in Athens, and then Ricky in Vegas, and David Haye going from cruiserweight to heavyweight, I guess.
Yeah, I think growing up in Manchester helps. It's a massive sport in Manchester, and I had friends that helped me start in the sport. You know, Sam Hyde was a cruiserweight up in Manchester that was probably the first fighter that I was involved with, and Mikey Gomez Jr., who people see that was on a show of ours a couple of weeks ago. He was one of the first boxers, Ryan Oliver. But in terms of love, it came from Amir Khan. I think it was the 2004 Olympics. I think I was 11 years old. I used to go to Bolton Wanderers with my dad, and Amir was a big, big star at Bolton at the time. And I remember when he came out of the Olympics, and he'd come to the games, and he'd be on the pitch, and I fell in love with him. To be honest, at that age, it was like, wow, you know, he was a local lad. And he was a guy that just became a superstar overnight and showed the power of boxing. And then you had those sort of ITV nights as well, where the audiences were huge and everyone could watch them. And it felt like a big deal. It was huge. And then Ricky Hatton was obviously slightly before my time in this, for his big nights at Manchester Arena. I was probably 12, 13. But the impact he had, I'll always remember Hatton Mayweather and staying up. Again, maybe 2007, and I must have been 13, 14. And then I think the one that really took me deep into boxing was Hay Valuev. And I think seeing David Hay go out there and take on what seemed to me like a man mountain. I mean, you're not a boxing expert at that age. You're seeing a guy like Valuev and you're thinking, how on earth can anyone beat him? How can David Hay, a former cruiserweight, go and win the heavyweight world championship against Valuev? And he did it. And I think that it was, for me, a form of beauty. I remember just being in awe of the way David went about his business that night. And from then on, I think I was absolutely hooked. And I think growing up in Manchester, as I say, I think is a big thing. Anthony Crawler was probably the first shows I'd go to regularly. 2016, 2017, he was at the arena a lot. And I got my promoter's license. I think I started maybe in 17, 18. So off the back of that.
And now you've worked with all these guys. Yes, like you promoted, obviously, Amir's last fight. You've worked with Crawler as TV talent. You've obviously crossed paths with David Hay probably quite a few times. Is that pinch yourself stuff? Or has it become normalised a bit now?
No, at that time, it is pinch yourself. It is. Anthony Crawler was a hero to me. But when I started, he was helping me out. It was crazy. He used to come to the Ultimate Boxer shows. Anyone that knows Anthony knows what a gentleman he is and what a great guy he is. And he still helps today with the charity Maverick Trust, who we do a lot of work with. And he puts so much back into the sport. But he helped me. He would come to the shows. He would, if anyone wants to look back and have a laugh, but my first press conference for Ultimate Boxer, which was after I'd done a few things in the traditional sport, I thought, this is the way to start. If I have no money, but if the fighters can sell enough tickets, we'll do the tournament, the eight-man tournament, and we can do it without TV. And this is the way I'm going to start. And Crawler helped. If you go back to the first press conference, I'm sat there. Crawler sat there and Hatton sat there. And I think that showed to me what boxing is all about, and especially Manchester at the time, that in my first tournament show, Crawler and Hatton, for no money, were willing to come down to London and help me out and get me off to a good start and put their weight behind it. And those moments will always live with me. And to be able to work with them now. And we even did Ricky Hatton's his comeback celebrity sort of fight as well recently. So I've worked with all of them, Crawler as well. But, yeah, they helped so much. And then to fast forward and then be putting on Amir Khan Kelbrook at the Manchester Arena. It was incredible. And that was the first moment I think my team felt, wow, you know, we're really onto something.
You mentioned the Bolton Wanderers thing and going there as a kid. Yeah. Were your parents into the boxing thing? Did they support the dream? Because it was law at uni, right?
Yeah, it was.
So it's quite a... Well, I mean, obviously, there's some crossover in the sense that law's pretty helpful in boxing now. But in terms of you and the boxing dream, were they behind it?
Yeah, I've got quite a crazy backstory that I don't think many people know. But my mum is Irish Catholic. So my granddad was a Belfast boy. And I used to go over there all the time and... He was just a hard-working guy. Had to work through the troubles and had a wine shop and inspired me. And then I had my grand on the other side, who was a Jewish Jamaican, and in a similar way had tough times that he had to go through. But both of them, you know, love sport, love boxing. I think my first introduction was there was a guy called Lucien Chen, and this is for the real boxing geeks, but he was a Chinese boxing promoter in Jamaica. And when Fraser came over to Jamaica, there was one show out in Jamaica in Kingston, I think in the late 70s. He was involved, and he was my granddad's best friend. And I think he worked with Aram on that show. And so my dad always had, you know, it was always a bit of like a fantasy what went on in boxing, but there was a shock, there was a when you've gone through and you've worked hard, and I did work hard, I studied law, as you said, and I worked hard, and I thought, right, this is a potential for me. And then to finish that and tell them that I'm going into boxing, you might like boxing, but to suggest you want a career in boxing is a completely different thing. And I think it seemed crazy to them. I think even to me, I didn't think necessarily, I think whether it would be a career at the start, I don't know. I just wanted to be involved. I couldn't be a fighter. I can't fight. I'd go to the gyms with my friends where I'd see the likes of Ryan Olivers and Sam Hyde and start to get introduced to the sport by helping out, as I say, with James Lindemann, who was a promoter in Manchester at the time. And I just, at that age, I don't think you think, is this, you're not thinking about...
There's no long-term goal.
No, it was just, I, of course I wanted to be involved. I saw a vision for a sport, but I wasn't thinking too deeply about it. I wanted to be in boxing. And I think, yeah, for a parents, they worry, but at the end of the day, they want you to be happy. And maybe they knew enough about boxing to know it was going to be a very tough career choice.
Has the law stuff been useful?
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
So at the start with Ultimate Boxer, what was the plan to use that as like a fledgling group to build this? You obviously said about Boxer being the brand that you wanted. Was it, I suppose this goes to where you're saying in terms of there was no long-term plan, but I suppose there must have been, right? Ultimate Boxer was the short term and the means to an end to start to get the show on the road.
Yeah, I think one of my biggest strengths is, yes, having the big visions, but really understanding the sport and the challenges that lay ahead and knowing how I have to take things step by step. And that was something I realised really early on was when I borrowed the money to get I had to pay 10 grand for my bond for the promoter's licence, and just thinking, right, that's the first step. Then it was helping out on other shows. Then it was like, how can I put on shows for TV without any money? And that's where the tournaments came in. It was short, it was fresh, it was transparent, it was easy to watch, but it was also inexpensive. I didn't have to sign any fighters. I didn't have to create any enemies, which I knew was number one goal when trying to break into the sport. I didn't want people to really know who I was, because I'd studied it. Because I started young, I'd seen how people operate and how they work. And there's so many great people in the sport, don't get me wrong, but there's reasons why it's so hard to break in. And whether it's contracts, whether it's leverage, it's like a virtuous cycle with TV signings, and it's to break into a sport, even in the US, even in the UK, you've got to do something pretty unusual or pretty special. I mean, it's been families running this, and so yes, always been bigger vision. But what's the next step? What's the step that we need to take to the next goal? And Ultimate Boxer felt like the natural step from doing small hall shows to being able to put on shows for TV, because I knew that would always be asked of me. Yes, you've done these small hall shows, but you don't have a clue how to promote on TV. You don't know how to put on shows for TV. You don't understand what goes on. And so I needed to find a way to put on a show that wasn't going to kill me, that I could put on TV, knowing that TV wouldn't pay me anything for it. And that's where the tournament came in.
So where does the entrepreneurial spirit come from? Is that something you had as a kid? Were you full of ideas and wanting to do stuff?
It came from... My parents split up very young. So I was spent a lot of time with my mum. I grew up with her, with my brother. She worked full-time. So I think the work ethic and being exposed to that every day definitely came from my mum. She's extremely determined woman.
Trying to find a way.
Yeah, always, yeah. Just never stopped, never, ever stopped. And so seeing that was good. And I think it first came, as I mentioned, my granddad in Belfast. I think he made me realise that you didn't have to get... I never saw his job as a job. He owned a wine shop and then it became a wine cellar. Now it's a wine distributor. And it was all from owning an off-licence in Belfast. And it was hard work, don't get me wrong. He was always there and he was always working. But to me, it looked like fun. It didn't seem like a job. He was so passionate about what he did. He was so involved with just being... He loved the business. He loves wine. He loves the background of it. And he just lived a life that I thought was in awe of. And he didn't have much money. It wasn't about the money. It was just about that he was passionate about something, and he did things on his own terms, and that was all. He showed me that that was possible, and in my head, that was the only route for me. And so throughout my teenage years, I was ducking and diving and finding ways, even at university, studying law, had a takeaway and the fast food and student nights, whatever it was, I would be looking for opportunities. And as soon as I got the studies out of the way, which really, if it was my choice, I wouldn't have had to do, I went into boxing.
So did you remain close to both parents?
Yes, so especially in recent years, you know, I'm close to my dad. He actually is a great source of advice for me, and they're both professionals in the sense my dad was a lawyer in Manchester, and my mum was an accountant, and so they worked hard, you know. But from a business perspective, they didn't own businesses. They wouldn't go into this, so they were always there to support me, but. I sort of just went on my own. I was always just a bit of a weird kid, and I would just go and do my own thing, and that's where it came from.
You know, when you look at the landscapes, obviously you talked about families running the show, and you look at Bob Arum, Don King in their 90s and that.
Yeah.
Are you in this for the long haul? Is this your, or do you see it as like you want to do it until retirement? Do you want to just, is this your life? I mean, obviously I know you're so young to be making that decision now, but like, what do you see yourself doing that stuff?
I'll be honest, I always saw myself as wanting to have a business, grow a business in boxing that can make an impact. It wasn't about being a promoter for me. I'll be completely honest. It was, and I still feel like that to this day. I have to respect the traditions of the sport. And sometimes I do things that I don't think right now, and it goes back to the point that you said about having to do things along the way, along your journey to get to the next stage. And for me, it was never about myself. It was never about being I don't feel like tonight's show is a Ben Shalom show. I feel like it's a boxer show. I feel like that's what, for me, is my drive. I want this company to represent something good in the sport. I want it to represent the staff well that have been with me forever. I don't want this to be about a person and an individual, and so I have great respect for the Don Kings and the Bob Arums, but do I want to follow like that? No, I want to build something, yes, very long lasting, very long standing. I see huge opportunity still, huge problems still in the sport, but yeah, a traditional boxing promoter is not what I see myself as.
I did see you during the weigh-in photos. You do a picture with you in the middle,
yeah,
and then you step away.
Yeah.
Is that something that you had in mind that you wanted to do and not be front and centre of every single picture? Is that a conscious decision you've made?
It is, and if there was another way, I think, you know, for me it's about boxer, and so I have to do certain things, as I say. There's certain traditions in the sport, and there's certain obligations from the broadcaster, and there's certain things that we will do because we're on a journey and we can't get to where we think we want to be overnight. But as you say, yeah, where we can, we want to promote the fighters and we want to build the brand. I want, as I say, people to come to the show tonight, going to a boxer show, not a Ben Shalom show. That's an absolute goal. We want this brand to be long-lasting, long-standing, and we want to build the fighters as big as possible. My job as a promoter, as much as people might have other ideas, but my job, I feel, is to make the fighters as famous as possible, make them as much money as possible, and give them as many opportunities as possible. That's the job.
And it's also, I guess, why you're the one promoter who's reached out to Dave Harris at Ringside Charitable Trust and said, we should do something at some point. And I don't know that you guys have actually sat down and had a formal meeting, but Dave tells me that you were very much open to doing something down the line, whatever it might be.
We work with a fair few charities, and I met Dave, and he has our full support, and he knows that, and we work extremely closely with Maverick Trust, and for me that's what boxing is. You know, boxing is a grassroots, community-driven, working-class sport that needs the TV shows to not seem a million miles away from the amateur clubs. It was so refreshing to me when I went to Manchester, and remember I was in Salford, and I was at the local boxing gym there the other week before the Akoli fight, and it reminded me why I fell in love with the sport. You know, I have to as I say, there's certain things at the top level that, you know, make you question things and make you forget about why you did fall in love. And that's the connection that we want to build with the local communities, with the aftercare for the fighters, and bring boxing to that place. And it's not easy, and people might say, well, no, this is bullshit, you've not done this, you've not done that. We can't do absolutely everything we want overnight. That's why Ultimate Boxer existed before Boxer existed. That's why certain shows we put on now, we'd like to, you know, it just is a journey, and that's what it is. I don't want to put other promoters down and say they should be doing this, they should be doing that. They all do things in their own way. But yeah, we're very, very passionate about it, and we believe that boxing can be a force for good. And the way boxing thrives and survives is that broadcasters and that sponsors are proud to be involved in the sport. And believe me, there's times where they're really, really not. And it's hard, don't get me wrong, and we'll make mistakes as well, and we'll have problems with on our journey. Don't get me wrong, we're learning. But that should be the goal of the promoting the sport of boxing. Should be the goal should be, you know, making it a better place to be involved in.
So you're not going to give me that clickbait, Ben Shalom goes in hard on Eddie Hearn, Frank Warren, all the stuff that we see on YouTube. Mm. That actually Matt Christie has called out in Boxing News, and I think I mentioned to you this earlier in the week, talking about that sort of, I will call it YouTube culture, where basically it's he said, she said. And I think Matt Christie hit the nail on the head in the sense that it probably drives a completely unnecessary wedge between you all.
I hate it. Honestly, I hate it. I think it's not media. I understand it's entertainment, etc. But I think it's very short term. And as you say, if the promoters and the main broadcasters aren't working together or aren't finding a way, the sport is finished. It doesn't grow. The fights don't happen, but not just the fights. The sport in itself just doesn't operate functionally if the main players can't find ways to work together. And yeah, the things we want to implement, we can't overnight. We're 18 months into our first big TV contract. We've signed enough fighters that we feel we've got a very, very powerful stable now. That then allows us to think about what's next and think about what's next again. But yeah, it is a shame that that's where the sport's gone. And I don't think broadcasters enjoy it. I don't think sponsors enjoy it. I don't think it helps the fighters. I really don't. I think it takes a huge amount of energy and attention away from it. And yes, I've been guilty. I've been goaded and caught up in times, and it's the last thing we want to do. And we are trying to find ways out of that. We are trying to find ways out of that because it's not helpful. I'm not blaming anyone, but ultimately, as you said, it can't be helpful. And as Matt Christie points out, the people that really care about the sport as a whole can see it. There's no way it can be helpful.
What's the biggest lesson you've learned in the last 18 months? Is there one that stands out where you think, oh, I wish I could get that back, or something else, in terms of, you know, a young Ben wouldn't have known? Not that you're not young now, but you know.
I think I'm a very open person, can be very trusting, which is difficult in the sport. But I think one thing is to stay true to myself. You know, sometimes, as I say, just what we were talking about, being caught up in conversations that don't matter or responding to things just because, you know, if you see people saying things that aren't true about you or lying about you or making up things, then it's hard not to respond. But I think I would just, you know, it is pantomime, and trying to stay out of it is better for the sport. And I think that's what I would say to myself, to sort of stay true to why, remember why you started. And the other week, as I say, this is how I used to feel. This was the excitement. This was the pleasure I used to get from going to a gym, and remembering that, because that will make me make good decisions. And I think that's it's been a reminder in recent months.
Your phone's been going like the clappers all week. Like, is fight week enjoyable or is it stressful?
Fight week is the most enjoyable part. For me, my work's relatively done. We have an amazing team. They'll tell you I'm absolutely useless when it comes to events, logistics. I don't even know how they all do it. I'm looking out over the stadium now, and the setup's incredible, and they're so good and they're so passionate for me. Yeah, 5 weeks is where the only time I really get a break, I would say, where I can talk to people that I like to work with, and that I get to talk to the fighters and really enjoy it. The rest of the time, it's 24/7, I would say. Yeah, fight week, although the phone is going, I think it's actually the most relaxed time for me.
How did the Sky thing come about? Obviously, you've done the Ultimate Boxer stuff. Was it who phoned who, and was it like, right, we're going with you, or was it you saying, right, I want to go with you? How did the relationship strike up?
So we had a few opportunities, a few offers from TV stations, not as powerful and not as big as we started to build the tournaments. And we would talk, and we were always around, but we knew that for what we wanted to achieve, that Sky Sports was the holy grail. And especially to start as a promoter, you need a powerful one, and you need one that believes in what you believe. And they've done so much for British boxing over the past 30, 40 years. That was the one that we wanted. And I think 12 months before the split with Matchroom, maybe 18 months, we knew that was gonna come to an end. And so we started preparing, and we started investing in our infrastructure. And we started thinking about what we would do, what would the vision be, how could we change things, what were the fighters that we'd like to sign, the Ben Whittakers, the Adam Azims, the Caroline Dubois. We had earmarked a year before. We knew what we wanted to achieve. We knew it was going to be so tough, because we're up against promoters 30, 40 years in the game, huge amount more money, huge amount more experience, huge amount more know-how, but also the ability that they've always had to shut people out. And so we had to be extremely agile, extremely efficient, and bide our time. And by the time the deal came around, I think the Sky execs were so bemused, but also impressed by the level of detail, the level of preparation, the level of hard yards, the level of clear planning that we put in, not just myself, John Wishusen, who's the head of boxing with us and is probably one of, if not the most respected man in British boxing. And we had the right team, we had the right plan. And we understood the challenges that Sky faced in terms of staying involved in the sport. There was a lot of things at the time, more so probably, where there were a lot of reasons for broadcasters not to want to be involved in the sport, and things that might put broadcasters off. And we had to present something that could keep them in the sport, that could keep them proud of the sport in a safe environment, in a safe way, and a long term vision as well. Not here tomorrow, here today and gone tomorrow, and here we're going to do a massive pay per view event next week, and then it's all going to fall apart. It was let's take a long build. And that's invest in the infrastructure in British boxing.
So when you're talking about that, Sky, obviously, that, you know, you could foretell there was going to be a void with the move to DAZN, and you wanted to do that, and obviously Sky might have been second guessing it, because at the time when you emerged, people did think you were an MTK shill.
Yeah.
And that was your thing, that you were I think you might have had a better word for it than me, but that you were a puppet or a front man.
Yeah. Well, definitely for something. I've seen all sorts, whether it's Illuminati or some Jewish conspiracy or...
Someone actually asked me your religion, but yeah. I'm going to go back to where we were. But yeah. Are you Jewish?
Well, my mum's Irish Catholic, you know.
Oh, so you follow your mum?
So that traditionally you follow your mum. Look, yeah. I've had exposure to a lot of things, and a lot of different religions, and so... Yeah. I've had family on both sides.
Are you religious?
I'm not religious. Oh, okay. I'm not religious. It's quite...
It's interesting, because someone on the phone asked me earlier, he said about your background. So yeah. He was wondering, because he's Jewish. Sorry, I digress. Yes, yeah. So you know, there was the allegation that you were some kind of puppet front man.
Yeah, and look, it's difficult because there are a lot of preconceptions and... Of someone, especially when the plan for us was that no one would know who we were, and that was going to be the easiest way for us to actually get the deal that we wanted to get. But yeah, hearing things like that were at the time, you know, you look back and laugh, and but at the time, you know, it's hurtful, and I still see things today that aren't true, and that goes back to my point of just staying true to yourself. You know where you've come from, you know who behind you, you know what you've had to work for to get to this stage, and not to get involved in the games, and whether people actually truly believe that or were just trying to find a way to, and still do, to stop us within the sport, or to stop us keeping to grow and staying on course with what we want to achieve. I think it's very clear now, you know, where we've come from and who we are. But yeah, again, I don't even want to comment on those things, because they're so ludicrous to us that yeah, that's it.
Let me ask you, while I've got you on the ropes, not on the ropes, that's not fair. You've done all right with that.
Yeah.
You were videoed, obviously, once saying you didn't want any matchroom questions. You obviously remember that. That went viral. What with hindsight, I mean, what's the deal? Do you want to know where? Because I'll be full transparency. You haven't asked me for a single question.
Yeah. No, it's not. It wasn't about that. That came from, first of all, I've started this business from scratch. So at that time, do we have the big PR teams? Do we have the big, you know, we're doing everything ourselves. And I think at the time it was, goes back to your point, I didn't want to get involved with the back and forth that was being created. It doesn't help.
So
it doesn't help
our
sport.
If you were going to be asked about it, at some point someone was going to put some gasoline on the fire.
It was going to
take one of the whatever quote they could have taken.
Every time, it doesn't matter how respectful I am in an interview, you can find from this interview, I'm sure, three words that can set something on fire. Like, that is what this is about. And at the time, it was very innocent. We were at a Richard Riotpoor press conference. I wanted to speak about Richard Riotpoor. I knew what was going to come. And there's 15 cameras all asking exactly the same questions, and all just want a reaction to go back and say, do you hear what Ben said about this? What do you think about this? And then come back to me and say, this is what they said. I know it has to happen. And I sound like, you know, I don't understand the reality, but that's all it was. And I want to avoid unnecessary crap. I don't mind any, as you said, I'll sit down for an hour with anyone if they want to have a proper boxing conversation and talk about the sport and talk about things that are going to help and the sport and get to know me. No problem. But the clickbait and that sort of stuff isn't helpful to the sport. I wish could end, and I appreciate people have to earn a living, and I really do, but there's other ways, I believe.
So I suppose as a part of that, obviously your face is all over Sky, social media, and obviously the YouTube side of things as well. How has life changed now you're becoming so much more recognisable? Do you get this stuff? I'm sure, you know, it might not be Eddie Hearn millions levels, but I know that you're not necessarily striving for that. But like you said, it's the game. You got to play the game, right? And, you know, Eddie uses his brand to give his fighters the rub. It's part and parcel of it. But I suppose life has changed for you.
It has changed. I think for me, I would like to build a brand like Boxer that can be that in the sport. WWE gives huge amount of profile to its fighters via its brand, via its partners with, whether it's ESPN, whether it's BT Sport. We have the biggest platform that you can possibly get in Europe, and we believe we can build fighters in the right way. In terms of myself, life has changed in the sense of being recognised and things like that, but I enjoy it. Like, I love working in boxing, and it might sound that I don't at times, but I love it. It's just I see issues that we want to solve in the sport, and that's our main goal. I think the only change is maybe being recognised.
Are you comfortable under the lights, under interrogation or scrutiny?
I think I enjoy it, but I also am always conscious that I don't. If I I'm conscious in 10 years, if I got hit by a bus, and I'm always thinking, I want my brand and my business and the what we stand for to live on, and I want the company to be strong enough to live on. And so I am conscious at times of not making it all about myself. And people might say I'm hypocritical. There I am on press conferences, there I am on this. We're happy to do it. We respect the traditions of the sport. But our long-term goal is make sure that Boxer supersedes any sort of personality.
The tradition thing's interesting because, you know, when you came in, I saw some of the early interviews, and in my research, I've gone back to them, and you talk about things that are having a negative effect, long-winded undercards, the belt system, judging, all this stuff, still all the same old stuff. Yeah. You know, recently, I think there is a traction on, you know, the late start time of fights. You know, just as point of fact, you know, I've tried to get my other half, my wife and my wife is the same person, and my daughter and my son to stay up for fights, including Khan Brook, and they couldn't get through the undercard, and the main event started too late, and I lost them. And they went to bed. Same thing with the Katie Taylor fight last week. It's a challenge, therefore, for me to try and get them interested. And I know other people in the same boat. What, in terms of that, long-winded undercards, late start times, which is my thing, do you think the late start times is an issue? Or is that what you need to do?
Remember, you're battling with what the venue wants. You're battling with what the broadcaster wants. If it's a pay-per-view, you're battling again with what the fighters who are earning from the pay-per-view sales wants. And there's a traditional school of method that they do better when the main event's later.
Leave it late, more people come in.
That's that. But of course, you know, the goal, as you said, is to get people interested in boxing. That's why we put on tournaments. That's why we use the Sky platform, the Sky Showcase platform. We're investing hugely in women's boxing. We want to make it easier to watch, easier to engage with, easier to understand at the peak times around other sports. We do, but there are certain things, as I say, I'm 18 months into it. We had to prove that we could even put on a pay-per-view show at the start. People said that we couldn't do that. We had to prove that we could sign a fighter, an Olympian, develop a fighter, take a world fighter to a world title opportunity, do stadium fights. We have to tick a lot of boxes in a sport that I respect and is a very traditional sport to be able to implement the type of change that we want to see.
Sure.
And that's it.
In terms of that, though, and let me just ask this while I've got you. Do you think there is the opportunity to get a huge audience at 8 or 9 o'clock, as opposed to, like, the Casey Taylor one went off at 5 past 11, I think, last Saturday night?
I believe there is, and I can see it. There's a reason why football games don't take place at 10
o'clock.
Yeah,
or anything. Or, yeah, you know, X Factor, whatever it is, none of them put it on that late. Yeah, sure.
I think I can see it. We did a show on a Sunday afternoon recently, and we did huge numbers for Adam Azim. I think what Adam Azim's viewing figures were better than Yar, better BF. And obviously, I understand there's platform differences and this and that. But if you do put it in the right window and the right platform at the right time, it can do a lot better. I think to balance it, people, venues, broadcasters have reasons for why it tends to be later. There's also the undercard slots and the fact that you want to develop other fighters, you want to look after other fighters, you want to give them their opportunity at the 8 and 9 o'clock to potentially main event one day. If we believe that this is going to help the sport and create bigger numbers and create more fans, then of course it's something that we'll be looking at.
The belt system, obviously back in the day, there were lots of WBU title fights on the TV, IBO title fights. Is that something that you're precious about as a promoter? Do you not want to go down the marginal belts and that kind of stuff unless you have to? Or is that even on your radar as something that you aren't fussed about? If it happens, it happens. It's more about the fight.
I think there's... It's more about the fight, but I think the biggest thing for me is the meritocracy in boxing and with the belt systems. I think there's a lot of that's be said around, oh, this governing body's in this promoter's pocket, or this governing body's in this promoter's pocket. That level of acceptance of why do we accept that that's the case? Because that's not a sport.
It's insane, isn't it?
It's insane. It's insane. It's just like ingrained. But for me to say it, people laugh and say, "Oh, that's the way boxing is." Over time, that will change if we can. But we, right now, we are, as I say, in a sport that's been around a lot longer than we have, and we're a small player. As it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we're only in the UK, and we're building. But that is the fact. Things like that, meritocracy, making sure a fighter, if they're good enough, knows that they can fight their way to the top, because that's not the case at the moment. Unless you're with the right trainer or the right manager or the right this, and someone that's playing the game at the top and manoeuvring things and has a best mate here or here, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, these guys do want you to get into bed with them. They want you to spend $5,000 on an advert in their programs, and they want you to go to their conventions and play the games.
And as I say, a uniform investment in each governing body from each promoter based on their size or whatever is fine. We understand the sport needs to be funded. The British Boxing Board of Control are funded by the promoters in the UK. That's fine, and I think that should be done. But as you said, the way it's done and the acceptance of it, and as I say, people say that's boxing, and it is boxing right now. I'm sure it's boxing for the foreseeable. But one day, you do hope that the sport can get to a place where it's run like a proper sport.
And it's not accepted. Sure. Accepted. Are you always looking to add to the stable?
No. Again, you want to sign fighters that you can look after. You want to sign fighters that can fight regularly. I don't like fighters that aren't fighting 3-4 times a year. And you want fighters that you can deliver for. So at the start, it was... right, we need fighters. We'd go off and we'd be signing. We had no stable. But right now, I believe, even impartially, outside of the heavyweight division, we have the most exciting stable over the next couple of years coming through. We want to focus on creating superstars in the sport. We believe that's what grows the sport. You see the Kell Brooks, the Amir Khans, the Tyson Furies, the Anthony Joshuas, what they do for the sport, but the fact that they're coming to the end. Who are the future stars? That's what we're focused on. We'd love to give opportunities to as many fighters as possible. I think the tournaments is something we want to get back in place more regularly. We want to find a way to work with small hall promoters so that we can get that on Sky Sports streams and things like that, because opportunity is what you want to create as a promoter. You want to be able to create it, whether you're born in Bournemouth or you're born in Glasgow or Newcastle or London or Manchester. Yes, there'll be certain fighters that we have to focus on and take care of and make sure we can get them to the top of the sport. But for us, it's how do we set up an infrastructure with Sky Sports, with the small hall, with the board, so that opportunities can come for more and more fighters.
I know we're playing theoretical stuff here, yeah. But a couple of years from now, do you think you'll have 3 pay-per-view stars in Caroline Dubois, Adam Azim and Ben Whittaker?
I believe Caroline Dubois will be the face of women's boxing. The whether women's boxing has got to a stage yet, which it still hasn't quite. I think Shields Marshall we could have put on pay-per-view. People might say that, but we saw the numbers. We could have put that on pay-per-view. I think Caroline Dubois could be the one that does it, that can do it. She's 21 years old. She's phenomenal.
You think she's the biggest punching female in British boxing?
I think she is. She is a freak and a delight to work with. And also, a lot of the fighters that turn over in the women's sport are usually, put Clarissa Shields aside, you know, turning over in their 30s. You know, this girl is 21 years old, still growing, still growing physically, mentally. But she's got everything. Honestly, she's got everything. She's gonna. I watched the Breakfast TV show she was on recently, and I couldn't believe that was the same girl that I met 12 months ago when we signed her. And look, she's 5 fights in. It's early days, but yeah, for me, she can be the first one. And Adam Azim and Ben Whittaker, without doubt, future box office stars.
How do you find these people? Are you the one that does the scouting?
I have a lot of good people.
I know, obviously, Ben was a star as an amateur, really stood out at the Olympics as well.
Yeah,
so I'm not
I have a lot of good people, and luckily a lot of people in the gyms, whether it's John Wischusen, whether it's Carl Greaves, whether it's Al Siesta, whether it's the trainers that I have great relationships with. But there's certain fighters that, you know, there's fighters that can really fight, and then there's fighters that can do things that people haven't done before and that can excel, and they have that sort of star power. And I think with Ben and Caroline and Adam, there's something very special about being in the company of greatness. I really believe there's something, and you can feel it when you are, and that's the feeling that we look to have. From, yes, not everyone can have that, but for the ones that we think can get to box office, that's what you're looking for.
Are you? Does Boxer go beyond British promotions? Is that what you're? Is there a medium or long term goal of going abroad, or are you happy to be here?
Boxing has no language barrier. That's always been the dream, and we want a brand that can exist in every territory where boxing will take us. And we've started in France. We expect to have a deal there next year that we're excited about. And yeah, we want to make sure local promoters all over the world are working with each other to grow the sport. And there's so much potential for boxing now, especially in this day and age with the amount of broadcaster competition and the developing countries. And you look at the places like France, Germany, South Africa, Australia, places that are really, really interested in boxing don't necessarily have those superstars, don't necessarily have that infrastructure. That's where we'd like to make a difference.
What about Vegas? Would you like to do a show in Vegas as a promoter?
I think the US is synonymous with boxing, and the US and the UK are the two biggest powerhouses. And to put on the biggest fights, you need to, at some point, have a presence on both sides of the pond. And yeah, of course, that's a big dream of ours.
And with regards to Adam Azim, in terms of the type of fighter he is, he obviously got rounds under his belt last time. Is that the sort of thing that you're happy to see? Because it's tough. We touched on social media earlier. The instant reaction is, oh, he's gone 10 rounds. He's a hype job. He hasn't chinned this guy in 30 seconds. But from a promoter, you want these reps, the rounds and reps, right?
I actually believe boxing Twitter is a very small, small percentage of boxing fans. I think not every boxing fan is tweeting crap on Twitter.
Are you on Twitter?
5 minutes, no.
Okay.
Not
because,
every...
because were you driven off it
because
by the negativity?
I think if I make my decisions via what Twitter want the next fight to be, I'm going to be a lost cause. It's unbelievable. Anyone can have an opinion on it, and I think there's people very vocal on Twitter, and I think for me it's a small percentage of the boxing fans. And for Adam Azim to get 10 rounds in his 8th fight against a ferociously stubborn Santos Reyes and a guy that can take serious punishment was an absolute dream. It was an absolute dream. It's hard to find anyone that will go a few rounds with Adam. It's hard to find anyone that will get in a ring with him. And for him to feel comfortable in the 8th, 9th and 10th with a bad hand, and to be able to slow down in rounds, and to be able to take the pace out of a fight, and to be able to be comfortable in front of an arena sold out on Sky Sports with 500,000 people watching, and not feel under pressure to just go and blitz a kid in one round. It was. I couldn't have been happier. And I think, you know, again, I see all sorts of stuff. When you're developing fighters on the broadcast, on a big platform like that, everyone has an opinion. You know, I've been told Caroline Dubois shouldn't be on TV until she's fighting for titles. I mean, what kind of ludicrous is that? This is a special star, special athlete that we get to witness develop. And we get to witness do things that hopefully others haven't done before. Fraser Clark. Had a 6-rounder and should have, and Boxing Twitter wanted him to fight Fabio Wardley in his next fight in potentially 3 weeks' time. I want to develop the fighters in the best possible way and give them every single chance of being superstars. Yes, they're going to be in big fights in the next 12 months, but yeah, things like the Adam Azim stuff and the Caroline Dubois stuff, I have to laugh. But I do think it's a very small percentage. I will say that there's a lot of boxing fans, and when we put on shows and 500,000 people are watching it, how many people are actually tweeting crap on Twitter. I mean, maybe a couple of thousand. So you have to take it with a pinch of salt.
Last couple for me, because like I said, you've got somewhere else you need to be today. Ben Whittaker, do you think he can get in the mix with Boazzi and Yard, or is he just a generation behind?
I think he will. I think he is going to develop very quickly. I think he's got his injuries out the way now, which is such a relief, because he was struggling. He was struggling in his first fight. He was struggling even during the Olympics, you know. And so for him, I believe, from speaking to everyone now and himself, he's feeling better than ever. I think he's going to catch them. He's going to be in the mix. And he's one of those fighters that... Chris Eubank Jr. is one that I've really enjoyed working with, because he knows how to sell a fight, but he's also extremely charismatic, and I think people have really enjoyed his last few fights, win or lose. But he wasn't like that after two or three fights. Ben Whittaker is a... And it's not fake. Anyone that knows Ben Whittaker knows he's a quirky character. He's an interesting guy. But he's a born showman. He's a born entertainer. So for him to be able to operate under the lights on his debut, in his third fight, in the way that he's doing, is special. And I think you can't deny that. The noise he creates, the numbers he creates, the interest he creates. And you talk about your wife going to the boxing and wanting to be at the boxing. And it's the same with my partner. She comes to the boxing from time to time. But when Ben Whittaker's fighting, she wants to come. And that says a lot.
What he's doing is divisive, though, right? Some people love it, some people hate it. But ultimately, look what that did for Naz and for Floyd.
Exactly. I mean, no, in this sport, and this is what I say, and Fraser's had to get used to it now. I feel like there's no other sport that gets the level of scrutiny and criticism on a fighter. But look at Anthony Joshua, look at Tyson Fury, look at the... One day they're a hero, the next day they're the villain, and it's up and it's down, and you've got to be able to handle it. And Kell Brook talks up to me about that all the time, Amir Khan as well. At that top level, when there's a scrutiny, comes huge criticism from time to time, as well as the huge praise and adoration. You can't take either seriously. If you get caught up on the hype train and the this, you're going to come crashing down in this sport very, very quickly. And as you said, the greatest fighters enjoyed the divisiveness, enjoyed the criticism, enjoyed the praise, enjoyed it all, because it's all part of the game.
So 12 months, the perfect 12 months from now, What do you do? Do you have way markers that you want to achieve in the next 12 months, or is it just keep doing what you're doing?
No, I think it feels like a tipping point now. We've got to a point where we're really, really happy with the stable. We've had to go through things as sort of necessary evils in a way. Boazzi, Akoli, coming over, 12 months out the ring, huge amount of ring rust, huge amount of changes going on in their lives, having to give them a fight that no one really wants to see, because they're about to go into the hardest fights of their career. And same with the guys that we've developed, the Adam Azims, the Caroline Dubois, the Fraser Carts, the Ben Whittakers, the Callum Simpsons, the guys that we feel now over the next 12 months can be in the fights that everyone wants them to see, can be in those title fights, can be in the moments that make us all boxing fans. It's a tipping point for us, and it's been frustrating at times. With Savannah Marshall and Richard Riatpour and Dan Aziz and Tasha Jonas, we've had fighters ready to go, and Chris Billam-Smith, and we feel like we've over-delivered. We feel like we've done absolutely everything. We've turned them from middle of the cards to superstars, to headlining, to getting the titles that they want, to getting the opportunities that we want, and it's given us so much confidence that we can now do it with our young stable as well, and that's what's so exciting for us about the next 12 months, because, we feel we can operate like the boxing promotional business that we want to be. Because sure. we have the talent to do so.
Brilliant, Ben. Well, thank you so much for making the time to speak to me. I'm really grateful. It's really good to sit down with you.
Cheers.
Thank you,
mate. Cheers.
I found that a really refreshing conversation with Ben. He has a few trusted advisors around him that I think he name-checked in that interview. They've been around him since the start of Ultimate Boxer. Thought that was interesting, obviously, about the UFC's intervention, about the Ultimate name as well. Lots of stuff I didn't know in there, it was the first proper sit-down conversation I've had with Ben, first time our paths have properly crossed. And it was really interesting. I found him engaging, an hour shot by. I did say that I would keep it to an hour just because obviously it was the day of such a huge fight in Bournemouth. You could hear the sound checks in the background probably. That's what that was. And what a show it was as well, by the way. There's a story that I've done in Boxing News coming out this week with Shane McGuigan, Barry McGuigan and Chris Billum-Smith, which is one of my favourite pieces I've written in quite some time. By all means, check it out. But back to Ben, I thought he was really interesting. He's trying to break the mold. I don't even know if he's trying to break the mold, but he is breaking the mold. He is doing things differently, and he is doing things his own way. He is being his own man, and he is running his own race. And you have to admire that for a guy who's sticking to his guns at the young age, and he could be going down other routes, and he's not. And I just thought it was really interesting. And we talked a lot off the record as well over the last few days, and I really enjoyed his outlook. It's just so different and like I said, very refreshing, and it was really interesting to be able to get to sit down and chat to him about his rise, about his story and his background. It's just not your archetypal story, and it just makes it really enjoyable. I hope you enjoyed that. Huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, and they are a leading provider of professional fire risk assessments and safety services nationwide. They provide expert impartial advice on all aspects of fire, health and safety compliance, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. As I mentioned at the top, there are podcasts up on my Patreon page already, with Timothy Bradley, who's been inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame this week, and with Johnny Nelson, who's come back for a part two. Johnny was brilliant, talking about the cruiserweights, talking about Usyk, talking about Joshua, and lots of his own anecdotes and his own career, partly based on the fact that we were speaking on the fifth anniversary of the death of Brendan Ingle. So some great stuff in there with Johnny. Fabulous stuff. 90-minute chat with Timothy Bradley. Huge thanks to Ben Shalom for joining me this week. Huge thanks to you for listening, and we will be back next week.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.